This is the United Podcast Network.
This is Voices in Validation, brought to you by IVT Network. IVT Network is your expert source for life science regulatory knowledge. Voices in Validation brings you the best in validation and compliance topics. We interview industry experts from pharma, biotech, med devices, and laboratories. Here is the host of Voices in Validation, Stacy.
Welcome to Risk Revolution, a monthly series that's part of Voices in Validation, brought to you by the IVT Network. The goal of this series is to advance maturity of risk management practices within the industry by covering topics that challenge quality professionals in seeking opportunities to improve and advance the ways in which they perceive and manage risk. This week, our series coordinators, Lori and Nula, invite their guests, Gada Haddad and Vivian Rowland, with a timely discussion on risk culture. Due to the breadth of this topic and the upcoming holidays, we will release this in two parts, with today's episode really laying the groundwork around risk culture, followed by the conclusion of our discussion in January. It looks like we're set for a lively discussion. Welcome to all four of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Stacy. It's great to be back with you. And as we said on this time on Risk Revolution, we're reading straight into a topic very close to our hearts. For Lori and I, which is how to build and sustain a healthy risk culture within our organizations.
Yeah, thank you, Stacy, for having us for this topic. This one is very important to Nula and I. Of course, we've talked about it quite a bit, and I think we've even mentioned it in other podcasts as well, other sessions. But for me, it's really critical that we build this risk culture. A lot of times, I think in industry, we get really wrapped up in tools and procedures, and we forget about the behaviors and the attitudes that need to go with that. And I'm also excited to have Gada Haddad and Vivian Rowland from Merck to join us today as well. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Lori, Nula, and Stacy. It's a pleasure for us to be here and to be invited to share our thoughts about the importance of risk culture in the industry. And also Vivian will share her ex-regulator experience with us as well.
So very important. Thank you.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. But listen, I think some recognition is due before we start. We couldn't possibly press on this week without, you know, taking a moment to recognize. And as we're talking about culture, it's always good to start with some recognition about the tremendous efforts that we've seen by so many across the biopharmaceutical industry and our colleagues in the international regulatory ecosystem, which saw Vivian's former colleagues from the MHRA winning the race, thankfully, and granting the first temporary authorization this week to Pfizer and BioNTech's COVID-19 vaccine. We have all been waiting so long for this. And no doubt, hopefully, it's going to be followed hot on the heels by similar approvals for this and other products, because we're so lucky that we have this pipeline of products coming through in the US and EU and all the other regulatory agencies.
Yeah, I definitely agree, Nula. I just want us to stop and think too for a second how much when the world works together, how much we're able to achieve, and that we were able to do this within the same year, really, that this pandemic took hold of the world. And I think that's something to really stop and think about, how technologically advanced we've become in pharma, that we were able to accomplish this in this way. And I'm excited also of what this could bring for the future in terms of other drugs down the pipeline, approvals, and how regulators look at maybe expediting some important drugs for supply for patients.
Yeah, I agree with you, Lori and Nula. This is a tremendous accomplishment by the pharma industry, and perhaps a great example of using the quality risk management principle in designing the manufacturing process to still ensure product quality and patient safety, although the whole process is taking perhaps a year, which sometimes takes 10 years or more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and agree. This is such a wonderful news. We've been waiting for such a long time, especially with the time that we've been going through under the COVID-19 pandemic. So it gives many challenges to the agency where there can be impact to the work that have impact to the industry, the National Health Services, or the, even the patients is more importantly. But I think to get these results, it is based on obviously the MHRA expert scientists to perform a scientific assessment of all the data that they have as the evidence of the quality and also safety as well in order to approve this vaccine. So, and again, it is, I think it's a very, very good example for having a good QRM where they can obviously evaluate the risk to the qualities based on the scientific knowledge and ultimately linked to the protection to the patients and obviously the general public as well.
Yeah, amazing. So, okay, well, listen, let's get started. Laurie, I'm going to go to you first and ask you if you could kick off by defining what do we mean when we talk about this risk culture? And perhaps more specifically, how does a healthy or what does a healthy risk culture really look like for you?
Yeah, thank you, Nuala. Okay, so how do we define a risk culture? And I think that's something that we've struggled with across the industry and sometimes in cases don't even necessarily try to build or acknowledge at times. So I think there's a couple components I consider when I think of risk culture at a very high level. One is, what is our attitude or perception of risk? How do we view risk when we are, as a company, are we identifying, are we looking for them? And when we do, are we afraid of them? Do we ignore them? So what's the behavior is the second piece. When we identify risk, are we open to understanding that risk and exploring mitigations for that risk or forming risk acceptance rationale for that risk? Or do we sort of hide from it, not acknowledge it, or put it back under that rock that we lifted up? I think those are the two major components that then equate to building a risk culture. But the most critical piece about that is, how is senior leadership driving that culture from above? So are they open to identifying risk, talking about risk, escalating risk up through their governance structure? Or would they rather us just move forward and not stop and think about those potential problems that could arise? And then once those forecasted risks are identified, do they want to put those resources where they need to be to mitigate those risks? I would argue at times we are challenged with this. So we oftentimes are really excited about firefighting when issues arise. We put all our people towards that and all our money towards that. But when it's a potential risk, we sort of hem and haw, well, could it really be realized? How much money do we want to invest in that? If we don't know if it's really going to happen. So I think those are the two kind of struggles that I see with senior leadership. Furthermore, and I think God will go into this a little bit later today in the podcast, but when we hear about a red risk, do we want to run away from it and hide from it? Or do we want to explore it and understand, do we need to accept that red risk? And a perfect example, especially in pharma, especially with some older companies, are sometimes we have to accept risk where maybe a facility is a little bit older, but we're phasing it out, right? So perhaps we need to put some short-term mitigations to keep that facility going for the next year or two, but accept that it may be a little bit out of the risk realm that we want it to be in, but we're going to put short-term mitigations in there to manage it. So we need to accept that risk. Sometimes taking risk is okay, right? Because it needs to keep the business going. So I think we need to understand sort of what's our attitude and perception around risk. Are we identifying them? Are we bringing them forward? Are we encouraged to do that by senior leadership all the way through? Are we then actively mitigating and putting resources and time and money towards managing those risks? And then lastly, are we reviewing those risks? Are we going back and seeing, did we successfully manage that risk? Do we have metrics in place to see if we successfully and effectively manage that risk? That sees it through towards its whole life cycle. And oftentimes I see bits and pieces of that where we're super good at it and not seeing that all the way through end to end, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
And then so
Yeah. What about you, Gada? What are your experiences?
Yeah, so I think the fundamental issue here is perhaps the word risk. Maybe if we choose a different terminology, like, I don't know, an event, maybe, because I think there's a lot of pushback on that terminology, like risk is associated with something bad, right? And it's hard to kind of accept that something bad is in your process, right? So there is, from my experience, a pushback from leadership and also from those who review the identified risk, such as the Risk Management Committee. And when they do this review, they kind of start questioning, is the risk truly high? Right? Because somehow it indicates that this is bad. And in fact, in my mind, it shows maturity of an organization when we truly are able to identify issues, right, before they materialize. So it's more about understanding where we are in our process and what kind of controls we have in place to make sure that, you know, nothing bad is going to happen. And I think also it goes back to the education or the competencies of those involved in the risk management process, right? Really understanding their role and what is it about risk identification or QRM in general. It's a potential. We're trying to be proactive. Potential, right? It's not real until it's realized. So we shouldn't be afraid of it. We should actually celebrate it, right? That, hey, look at us. We've identified this potential risk and we're going to make sure that we have controls in place so it doesn't realize. So this is a big win for us instead of being scared of it. Another leading indicator of the risk culture of a company is how some perceive the risk register, right? MHRA, and Vivian will touch on that. It's a kind of a legal requirement for them. They ask for it. Some leadership thinks that, hey, you know, when we show our risk register, then we're handing the regulators, you know, observations on a silver platter. And that's you know, totally a false perception or assumption. I think regulators, and Vivian can comment on that, will actually appreciate that. And it's a evidence that the company really understands their processes and how they manage the potential issues. And also, it's a great risk communication tool, right? It is a sign of a strong risk culture. The risk register basically shows that they have a systematic process for identifying, managing, and communicating risks and their associated controls and mitigation. I think in the absence of a risk register, regulators might have concerns like, how does your risk communication process go? Right. And also, are you truly managing your risk effectively across your organization?
I love that the whole discussion around risk registers, God, I 100% agree. I think it definitely shows that open and transparent communication. And honestly, I think a regulator probably highly appreciates that transparency and probably gives them some level of confidence. But I, not being a previous health authority expert, probably am not the right one to answer that. So Vivian, can you tell us, if you dig back in into your past too, as being a member of HPRA, how does a health authority sort of look at that risk culture and any examples you have about that?
Well, yes, I think it is important that the company should ensure that the risk culture should be like consistent throughout the whole of organization. So that is your first communication. And obviously, we talk about the risk register. So that obviously can be the second communications to the regulators as well, which is also important. That obviously they can demonstrate how they can actually identify the risk and how what kind of actions and assessment they go through in order to apply the best remediations to minimize and control the risk as well. So obviously, that's all within the ICHQ9 process model. But other than that, from my experience, where you say being a regulator, I don't know, sometimes we're saying that we can be a little bit of a detective. You can sense that, you know, when you walk in the company, you can feel that, you can feel this, you know, how this audit or inspections is going to go, right? First of all, I mean, say from my experience, you know, you can tell a risk culture basically quite simply to tell if there's a certain senior managers not going to be in the opening or the closing meeting, then you can kind of tell really, do they really kind of like care about what is happening? Do they want to know what kind of assessment and any comments from the regulators coming to do that kind of external audits to give them the extra information in the office to help them to improve the company in terms of the process, the operations? I mean, being the inspectors, we're not there to find deficiency. We're not trying to penalize who has done it wrong. It's more important, even for us, to help them to identify what has gone wrong and how they can stop it and how they're going to manage it so that they can, you know, obviously make sure that it's not going to happen again. Or even though if there's no issues, then obviously the other better thing is to help them to do a continuous improvement. So I think it is very critical, and I think you know, the company should have a very healthy and a strong risk culture. And that is including like a clear and well-communicated risk strategy. And also it's very important to share the information across the organization as well. Because obviously the employee will be looking up to the senior management with their attitude, with their thinking and decision-making as well. And that will have very heavy impact to how they behave and how they think about risk, and especially the risk management as well.
That's great, Vivian. You just gave me pause there for a second, just about even who's present in the room, right? And what that tells you as a health authority. Although probably sometimes we keep certain people out of the room because they're a bit chatty. but it's definitely, you bring up an excellent point though. That's such a great indicator, right, of how transparent communication occurs throughout that company. Thank you, Vivian. So I have a question for Nuala too. You do a lot of work in the quality culture excellence area. So with respect to risk culture, what are behaviors that you would want to see in a healthy risk culture?
Yeah, well, you know, Vivian was just talking about the importance of risk communications and that transparent communications. And certainly that needs to be led from the top. But actually, from my perspective, sometimes that can be a process that works quite well. You know, somebody sends the memo or the risk communication goes out there. But what isn't often happening is that driven from the bottom piece of the risk communications of making sure that the folks in the front line, whether that's at the lab bench or whether it's, in the process area, that they also are completely aligned with that communication. And more importantly, that they are encouraged to speak up if they see something. So this is a key thing for me in any culture, in any organizational culture, and particularly in a regulated environment, that there is a systematic process by which employees are actively encouraged and empowered to speak up, to raise concerns, to remain vigilant in their day-to-day tasks, because they are the they are the seeking aspect of whether the risk control strategy is actually working or not. They're the detect part of the QRM process. I know we spend a lot of time looking at, do we have a detect, a detection element that we can score in to reduce our risk? But our biggest detectors are the folks in the front line who are closest to the work. So asking them to remain vigilant and for them not to let anything slide and to bring that to the fore. Now, of course, it's really important that we have that effective speak up invitation. Well, there's no point in putting it out there to everybody to say, yeah, everybody's empowered to speak up. Go ahead and talk, you know. A, if they don't have a forum to do that in, such as the tier meetings or at the beginning of any other opportunity or, through a good spot tool or an employee suggestion scheme. So you have to give them a systematic tool by which they bring that forward. But more importantly, people will volunteer their ideas and their creativity and their, you know, what they've seen only for so long. You will only get as much goodwill out of that if they don't see the leaders acting on behalf of the information that they've been given. So if the same, you know, lab operator or process tech brings forward something three or four times and says, you know, this is a problem. We ran into some near miss situation, and the leadership say, oh yeah, thanks for telling us that, and do nothing about it. They're going to stop. You're going to close down that channel, and now you've completely disenfranchised that detective element of your workforce. And of course, in order for those two pieces to work well as having, you know, the empowerment to speak up, and the invitation to do it, and then the leaders taking action on the basis of that, you know, recognizing that they can't react to everything and that there's a prioritization, but also feeding back that communication, that transparent communication, if they can't do it and why they can't do it right now. But to really embed those good habits, I would love to see, you know, our routine reward and recognition systems linked in. You know, if somebody has identified a near miss, that should be a celebration. As we said, you know, it's not the red risk that's been identified that we should somehow be frightened of or be fearful of. But if somebody brings forward a near miss situation or a potential near miss situation, we should be celebrating and rewarding that and recognizing that, and you know, and that then reinforces that in terms of a good habit. Now, in terms of, so the speak up part is a really important thing, but the other part for me that's very specific to the risk culture is the proactivity. I think our action bias around risk tends to be very either, you know, we're doing it prospectively because we've got a validation, we've got a new product introduction coming in, and therefore we have to do all these risk assessments prospectively. Great, okay. But most of the other time in industry that we see risk management in play is after an event has happened. It's retrospectively, you're reacting to a situation, and now we've got to justify our position, therefore we need a risk impact or a risk assessment done. So a lot of our risk management activities outside of those new facility startups or new product introductions tend to be looking in the rearview mirror at the event that's already happened. So I would love to see that as an industry that we could really start to shift. You started the conversation, Laurie, with mindsets and attitudes, and really shift our mindsets and attitudes away from the detect and correct cycle we seem to be locked in, which is a much more less mature mindset. And there's a lot of talk about maturity and quality in the industry now, and much more towards a prevent and predict model, which is a much more mature relationship with risk. And you know, we would see there's a lot we can learn from our brethren in the safety culture around this. You know, they've been doing this, and if we were to look at what they've been doing over the past two decades, they've transformed how they manage safety. And now safety is everyone's job. And that's really clear when you walk onto a site, that everybody's responsible for making sure they go home safely and their colleagues go home safely. And I would love if the management of risk was exactly the way that risk is everybody's job, not just those folks who have QRM in their title. You know, so risk management is that opening up, unleashing that energy, that potential energy in the organization around the elimination of hazards. And the final thing that I'd love to see here is, again, you borrowing from the safety industry, is that we have more respect for the hierarchy of risk controls. And you know, that we're looking at prevention and elimination and substitution really realistically before we get into, let's put in an engineering control, let's put in an administrative control, two pairs of eyes and another signature, or let's protect the person who's most at risk by sticking some PPE on them, which is, you know, really where we found ourselves with this whole COVID situation this year. We couldn't prevent, eliminate the hazard of infection control in the community. And we all had to man up and put our PPE on and mask up in order to protect ourselves because we were at risk. But now, obviously, hopefully the prevention program comes with this, with this new vaccine. So they're the three areas that are, you know, for me, that I think we really could work on. There's opportunity there for us in the pharma sector.
Thank you, Nuala. So I kind of briefly mentioned that Gada was going to speak a little bit more on this because her and I have had lots of conversations about the fear of red. So can you expand your thoughts on this,
Gada? So I think in terms of human heuristics and bias, right, I think there is an allergy to the color red. I mean, when we were kids, if you remember, when teachers would grade us, they would use a red pen, right? And so we associate red with bad, right? Like even when we're driving, red means stop, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the red color scares people, you know. And I know Lori from us having worked together in the past, we kind of thought, hey, maybe we can change the color red into like maybe purple. Right. And I wonder if we do that, if we're going to, you know, make a big impact in the coloring industry. Right. Yeah. So that now purple is seen as something bad. But I think we need to really focus on educating people. Like, what does it mean, red? Right. It's a potential risk, right? And the red means that we're prioritizing that potential risk over a you know, perhaps a risk that is medium or yellow, right? Or a lower risk. So it should be more seen as a way to prioritize the way we operate, to put our resources where we need it more versus to, you know, put the resources and the time to address something that is seen as low risk or that was rated as low risk, right? Yeah. So I think, and from my experience, we started something at Merck, which I'm kind of proud of. We started saying red is the new green, right? And that's to celebrate the culture or the change of culture that we are now embracing high risk or red risk as an opportunity to continuously improve our processes to ensure that we provide quality product to our patients, etc. Right? So it is just a color, and we are afraid of that color. And I think with, you know, education, and maybe there's an opportunity for me to talk about my research on competency levels and leadership and behavior, right? If people truly understand what it means to identify potential risks in general, I don't think they'll be afraid of a color. But it is a real thing, right? I mean, I don't want to see, even like in Word, when you're typing or it says red line, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, red is somehow of a scary color, except for Christmas, right? Christmas time, it's a good color. It becomes a really good color.
I totally agree. I think, and I always tell people, I don't care what color you put it, what number you put next to it, or what letter you put next to it. If you go high, medium, low, that risk didn't go away, right? Just mm-hmm. because, you know, we didn't. So Vivian, sorry, anything else to add from your side regarding red and this sort of bias in behavior?
Yeah, obviously, you say nobody liked the red color, but from my experience being the regulator in the past, if we have to ask, say, can I see the risk register? If to be honest, if they say that we can't find any color red, we'll be actually question a little bit more to say how they actually do this calculation. What model did they use that they can determine if everything just green and yellow? I think sometimes they say it's too good to be true. It's actually giving a bit of a false alarm alarm or a concern as well to actually look into a bit more detail. So I think obviously it is important. I say it should be transparent, you know, in that risk register. It's just like the senior management should be transparent with their employees within the organization as well. And obviously encourage them, as Lona said, that is to speak up, because they are the people who are on the work area every single day doing the activities. If it's any potential risk, they start creeping up, they will be the first one to know. And that's why it's important to let them know, yes, there's a channel, there's a formal process. Don't be afraid to talk about it. It's actually trying to find it and stop it and control it then, rather than having a big impact down into the supply chain. And that is going to be even worse in terms of ending up having like product recalls, even harm to the patient as well. And that is even to cost company a lot more in terms of the reputation, in terms of the confidence to the regulators as well.
I love that. I'll just close out this question by something I wanted to just add from that I heard from all of you is just that, or I guess to change this behavior is, imagine if we rewarded that risk, you know, identification, that proactive thinking, as much as we reward the reaction and the firefighting, which we tend to do, right? We love that. We love to give out rewards to those teams. Imagine if we gave out similar rewards, right, to that upfront, and how that would change the dynamic of things.
Yeah, that's an awesome example, Lori. I totally agree with you. We tend to reward firefighting, right, versus rewarding prevention, right, and taking the time upfront to design the manufacturing process, or to even take a time out to look at the current in place processes and try to figure out what can we do better to ensure that, you know, any potential, I keep using potential,
yes, potential
risk,
yes.
Right, do not materialize into real issues.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I would just like to add, just to, you know, literally to draw a line under this, until we stop rewarding the firefighting, we will continue to engender a nation of firefighters, you know, those of us who man the pump. And we've got to stop doing that. We've got to change the behavior so that we are rewarding proactivity, prevention, you know, being able to predict when an event is likely to happen, and then to look at mechanisms by which we can reduce the likelihood of occurrence of those events. So, good. I'm done.
Well, thank you to all four of you. This has been such an interesting discussion, and I really appreciate each of you sharing your experiences and your thoughts on this very important topic of risk culture. And just to quickly recap for our listeners, the first half of this episode, we've attempted to define risk culture, highlighting a need for risk identification, covering some risk management or some risk communication tools, and broadening the understanding around risk-based decision-making processes. And all four of you have really laid out the challenges in building a culture of risk. As the color red and fears around regulatory findings and management pushback prevail. So next month, we'll definitely continue the discussion on risk culture as we dive into solutions for learning and development of a top-down approach and supporting risk curiosity. We'll also have the four of you share more stories and experiences from industry to further illustrate risk culture and practice. So those are our thoughts and takeaways for our listeners. Until next time. I want to give a big shout out to Ben Kitchen, our producer, and the Studio 21 Podcast Cafe. Lastly, we are so grateful to you, our valued listeners, for joining us each week for this podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode, we ask you to subscribe in your podcast player of choice and share with your friends, colleagues, and online networks. We really do appreciate it, and it helps us grow and get more great information out there. If you have topic requests or guest suggestions, we'd love to hear from you about that. And for today's show notes, of course, and all those takeaways that were just mentioned, and more information on this podcast, please visit www.ivtnetwork.com. We'll be back again next week with another great interview. Until then, stay healthy and safe.
The views and opinions expressed by the hosts, guests, or callers of this program do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Studio 21 Podcast Cafe, the United Podcast Network, its partners.